Welcome to the Leadership Window Podcast with Patrick Jinks. Each week, through a social sector lens, Patrick interviews leaders and experts and puts us in touch with trends and tips for leading effectively. Patrick is an LSI certified leadership coach, a member of the Forbes Coaches Council, a best-selling author, award-winning photographer, and professional speaker. And now, here's Patrick.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 25 of the Leadership Window. I am Patrick Jinks, leadership and strategy coach and president of the Jinks Perspective, and a good old friend and colleague on the program today from way back in the days, in my early days of nonprofit leadership. And I will tell you, this is someone who had a great impact on my thinking, particularly in the realm of social sector leadership. And I'll tell you that story here briefly, but Hilde Gottlieb is our guest today. She is the founder or the co-founder of Creating the Future. It's a global nonprofit that teaches people how to create systems change through the questions they ask. So those of you that know me, been listening to this program or seen our YouTube channel or anything like that, you know that I've got a passion for questions and their use. And I make my living asking key strategic questions as a coach. And I don't know of anyone else who models it as much and as well and spreads it as effectively as Hilde. I could go into her bio and it would take the entire episode time to go into it, but she is the real deal. She's been a contributor to things like the Stanford Social Innovation Review and a blogger at medium.com. She's a TEDx speaker. She has multiple best-selling books. She has been in, out, and around this arena in all kinds of very unique directions, and social entrepreneurship and social enterprise and just you name it. Here's the deal. Hilde is all about creating real change, creating a better future, not just running an organization. That's how I probably would just describe her if I had to sum it up. And we engaged her back when I was at United Way in a southern town in Virginia, Danville, Virginia. Some partners with United Way engaged Hilde, who at the time was a nonprofit consultant. She's based in Tucson. Help for Nonprofits was her organization. And we brought her in to talk to our funders forum about how a funders forum in a community could do some great things. And among other things, one of the key things I'll never forget, Hilde, I'll never forget you saying this. You said that as funders, we keep telling our fundees that we want them to collaborate, but we as funders keep showing them a competitive model and not a collaboration model. I never forgot that. It was a powerful concept. And just a few years ago, you and I got reconnected through this amazing network that you've got online for nonprofit consultants. And boy, I could just go on and on. I'm thrilled to have you on this show. I'm totally honored. So happy new year. Welcome. Glad you are here.
There is nothing I can say that can top that. So it's been nice chatting. I gotta go.
All right. Here's the music. And we're out.
Thank you so much. I am just completely humbled by everything that you just said.
Hey, that's just, the only thing I lament, Hilde, is that we haven't been more connected through the years since we met, because I thought, you know, we hit it off well. I think you were the perfect voice at the perfect time for us and what we were doing there in Danville, which at the time was pretty extraordinary. And we could talk about some great things that actually led to. But you've done so much more since then. I've gone in a completely different direction since then, and I'm just glad we're reconnected. So I'm thrilled. I mentioned your organization, Creating the Future, which obviously sounds amazing. But obviously, we need to know a little bit more about that. I'm just going to start this off, opening it up to you, just open it to go wherever you want. But tell us about how you got here and maybe culminated in what creating the future is and what you're doing now and how your journey has kind of led to this point. Just let us know you a little bit more.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was raised in one of those households where my parents were not activists, but we were very socially aware. So I was raised on the news is on all the time, that we're politically aware. And as a good child of the 60s, that was in my DNA. And several iterations throughout life, I have been in the corporate world, I have been in the government world, I have worked for elected officials. I've got probably, centuries worth, what it feels like sometimes, mm-hmm. of experience. And eventually wound up doing consulting to community organizations. And that was in the early 90s. And about 5 years into that work, we had, my partner and I had come out of the for-profit world, wanted to do something that made the world a better place. We were both at that point of saying, okay, we got to get back to what we deeply believe in. And as we started to work with community organizations, we found that we were in demand. It was all of those things that as consultants and coaches, you dream of. We never had to do any marketing. We were working entirely by referral. Everybody thought we were just amazing. We were working all over the continent and sort of the consultant's dream, except that we had come out of the for-profit world and changed our lives so that we could make the world a better place. And we looked up about 5 years in and realized that we were supposedly at the top of our game, and yet we weren't seeing any of the organizations we were working with creating significant change in their communities. And to do a strategic plan, we were doing work pretty much those days the way everybody does it. We were doing planning the way people do it. We were doing governance work the way people do it. Doing that supposedly really well, but at the end of a strategic plan saying, you know what, that food bank is going to be no closer to ending hunger. They'll implement the plan. This isn't one that'll sit on a shelf, but they'll be no closer to ending hunger in their community than if we never showed up. So how can we say we're good at what we do if the result is that things aren't changing? Looking back through the lens I have now, what I realized we started doing as consultants is we started changing the questions we were asking. And at that time about strategic planning, we started to realize that classic strategic planning never asks, what do you want the community to look like because your organization exists? And what steps will you take to ensure, not, oh, we tried, but what steps will you take to ensure that that is what your community looks like? And strategic planning never asks that. What it asks is, what do we think we can accomplish in the next couple of years? What do we think we can get funded? Those kinds of things. What do we think is wrong that we need to fix? And so what that eventually evolved into was, we looked up about 5-6 years later, we had changed everything about the way we were doing our work. And we were starting to see shifts. We were starting to see shifts internally within organizations, and we were starting to see them make incremental shifts in their communities in ways they hadn't before. And we were just one group experimenting as we went. And at that time, this was 2007, 2008, we said, well, we need to share what we've learned. We've obviously got something, and our consulting colleagues were asking us, how are you, A, getting people to even think about these things, and B, how are you getting change to happen? And so we said, I needed to write a book. At that time, I wrote The Pollyanna Principles, which summarized what we had learned to date. And we need to teach this. And so what started out as just, well, we'll teach this, you know, consultants wanted to know what we're doing, we'll teach it to consultants. We were still consultants ourselves. And eventually, you know, as you well know, Patrick, when you teach others and you create learning communities, you learn from what they learned. So they were taking what they did, what they learned out into the world, bringing it back. And we were learning and adjusting and learning and adjusting. And eventually it became clear that we had something we really needed to share with the world, and that became Creating the Future.
Wow. A lot to unpack there.
So much
to unpack. But let me start with this. And I've mentioned it on this show, and I don't want to make this about me. I want to shift this pretty quickly. But I'm in the middle of a doctoral program right now in organizational leadership, and I'm writing a dissertation on mission metrics in the nonprofit sector, and the notion that many nonprofits still struggle with any kind of outcome measurement, even at a program level. Many organizations still struggle with it. How to measure results, like what are we actually achieving? Not how much money are we raising or how many volunteers we have or how many people came through our program, but what's actually changing, even if it's for individuals just within our niche, let alone the ability to turn to the community and from an accountability standpoint say, we are achieving our mission, for which the IRS gives us a big tax break, for which you depend on when you make a contribution to us. And here's how we know we haven't completely accomplished our mission, but here's how we know we're making progress on the mission. And so it's a qualitative study where I'm looking at how nonprofits are addressing this. So that's the setup. The purpose for that, and the reason I chose that, is because I, like you, have lamented the lack of actual change happening. I mean, this sector is big. It's a big part of the economy. There are 1.5, almost 2 million nonprofits in the United States alone now. There's billions in revenue, hundreds of millions in profits at the end of the year. Yes, not-for-profits make profits. But you look at the issues that the sector is trying to solve, like, and pick your issue. Housing and homelessness, early childhood education, health of a community, et cetera. And you look over 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years of this work, and you can point to some anecdotal things, and you can even point to some programmatic things, but so much really doesn't change. And I've got my philosophy on some of the reasons I think that is. But I would love to hear yours. Why is that the case? Why does the sector move slow? Why is it that we don't create the kinds of things that we can create, or certainly that we're striving to create? What are maybe two or three of the biggest barriers or obstacles or reasons for that from your point of view? And by the way, before you get into that, I mean, I hope everybody realizes you and I are in this world because we do believe and we do want to make a difference. And I'm not trying to bash nonprofits, but I am wanting to get a realistic picture of the sector and what the sector is doing, and how we always just want to be able to do it better. So what's your thoughts on that?
There's a couple things. And they're both equally important and interrelated. I'm a social science researcher by proclivity, by training. And so for me, the question is always going into what is it that creates change in the first place? Mm. Looking at organisms even, what is it that creates change? And why are we not changing? And so those from a societal and an individual aspect are my life, are what I spend my time thinking about, reading about, and digging into. One of the realizations that we have had, and I should start by talking about what Creating the Future is. You did ask me to end with that on my intro, and I didn't. So Creating the Future is we are a global organization focused on systems change. We basically teach people and help people create a future different than their past. And we're at this time in civilization right now, this year, this elongated 2020 that looks like it's going to be about five decades long. Everybody wants to know. We can't go back. going back is going back to what created this mess in the first place. What does it look like to create a future that's different than our past? And that is what creating the future's mission is. We work via experimenting and sharing what we've learned. And so we experiment on our own systems, our own internal systems, looking at everything from governance to fundraising to does it have to be the way it is. We do demonstration projects with others who have their own questions, and we apply a question framework that we call catalytic thinking, which you and I can talk about in a little bit. As part of our systems change mandate and mission, we have really looked at where do the systems that social change organizations, and I don't separate out nonprofit from social enterprise, from government programs, because you know the war on poverty was a government program and we still have poverty. So it doesn't really matter. It is how we look at change. And what became clear over many decades at this point of research is that the systems used within the social change arena to underpin the change, so planning and governance and fundraising and evaluation, the stuff, the infrastructure that is the same for every organization, not the mission, but everything else, how we develop programs, the stuff we all do the same. None of that was built to intentionally create social change. We have adapted and adopted systems from, let's go back thousands of years of church charity, where the goal was to help one person at a time or one group at a time. That eventually evolved. That model was adopted by the industrialists who created in the 1800s, early 1900s, their own charity, but again, from the perspective of we help one person at a time or one group at a time. We adapted that. And no surprise, we're very good at helping one person at a time or one group at a time. So many of our constructs, pardon me, come from the business world. So many of our constructs come from the military. Strategic planning comes from the military. Napoleon created strategic planning. So it's real good at winning a battle, but that's not what we're about. And so none of the constructs, the whole competitive arena, that competition is a good thing, competition is the way of life, that is capitalism and business infused into social change. And so none of what we do on the day-to-day basis was intentionally designed to say, what systems would propel social change? And as a result, if you look at the military, you look at business, you look at church, you look at industrialists, the systems we use to undergird, to the infrastructure stuff that we use to support social change that informs how we think about all of that comes out of power and privilege. And so what we are trying to do is dismantle power and privilege using systems that are rooted in power and privilege. We've never sat down, nobody's ever sat down and said, if there were none of these at all, if none of this existed, what would we build to propel social missions forward? And I will tell you, once you start asking that question, you wouldn't build anything we've got. So that is part one of why we see that frustration of we're all, we have a slide deck on our website, creatingthefuture.org, if anybody wants to go. But there is a slide deck there that I think it's called Beyond Sisyphus, because we all feel like we're pushing that rock up the hill and it just keeps sliding back down. And so what we've realized is that the work of creating social change, not the program side, but what it takes to be able to do that work, is in many cases counterproductive. And the second point to that is it is all rooted in questions that go counter to what we're trying to create. And so again, with catalytic thinking being the guidepost for everything that we do at Creating the Future, it really is a framework of questions that bring out the best in people, bring out the best in situations, and allow us to reach for and create the kinds of change that are possible. So it's the questions we're asking, but also where those questions come from.
I definitely want to get into that framework for questions, but let me back up and hit on a couple of things that you mentioned and just do some conversing with you on it. You know, you mentioned the way organisms change, and you mentioned the word catalytic thinking. I'm not a scientist of any sort, but I remember it might have been you that told me this. I don't know. I picked up from somewhere along the way that we use catalyst the wrong way. That we often use the word catalyst as, you know, this add-on or this even a reinvention, where the actual biological, someone's going to like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He shouldn't have a podcast. This is not a science podcast. So just tell me if I have the principle right. But it was explained to me, and this goes back to, you know, my biology days. What I remember about a catalyst now is that it inserts itself, but then removes itself. That it's not it's not a reinvention. We sometimes think about, the incubator concept, where in an organizational, let's a business incubator, for example. Well, that's great, but eventually that business has to have a system that can survive on its own. But I don't remember who it was that told me again. It might have been you, but just it resonated that when we use the word catalyst, we have to remember that a catalyst is a process or a chemical, you know, event that inserts itself to change. Comes out of a protein strand or whatever, but then it removes itself. And that's a different thing. And that's when we talk about sustainability, there's another term we use in this sector. Well, sustainability for most organizations means we just keep getting this grant. That means we're sustainable. whereas sustainability really is, we would sustain now once this grant goes away. Like, we can move on from this. Am I even remembering that concept remotely correct when we talk about catalytic thinking?
I think in plain language, absolutely. Catalytic thinking is a series of questions that that propel a different conversation. It is rooted in three sets of questions, and the questions go deep, and there's tons of them. but the first questions are about what is possible. And those questions lead us to create what is possible rather than react to what is wrong. So if we look at what the social change arena is focused on, the social change arena focuses on fixing what's wrong, which is reacting to what's wrong. And we can go to a million reasons why reacting to what's wrong is not the most effective way of creating change, and why it actually doesn't accomplish the change we want to accomplish. The brain science is that when we are reacting, we actually trigger the parts of our brains that get into that reactive loop without thinking. The part of the brain that is reactive, reflexive, is what happens when something comes at you and you react. Whether that is generally fear, but it is, and especially if we're talking, you know, picture a strategic planning session where you are talking about, or a program planning session where you're talking about the problem, and then you want to go deeper into what is the problem, and now we really need to analyze the problem, and you can feel the tension in the room. What's wrong, and what caused that, and what's to blame? And these aren't happy words. These do not make people feel creative and positive. And what actually is happening in the brain is that actually closes down our ability to think. So when we're in reactive mode, we can't think. At cortisol, actually, one of the things cortisol does is it prevents you from thinking, because thinking would get in the way of getting out of danger. So reactive at a brain science level is not our most productive. But the other thing about reacting to problems rather than creating what is possible is that we're actually reacting to the past, because what we are reacting to, what we're trying to reform, what we're trying to fix, is something that was laid the groundwork for all along in the past. We see it as the present, but it's actually the result of the past. And what we're doing is we're trying to fix the past. And I don't know about you, but I've not had very good luck with trying to fix the past. So when we look at what is realistic, it is why trying to fix problems, we're always running up against so many other things, because we are, it is physically impossible to fix what happened in the past. We can make changes that will create something better. And that's the difference between creating and reacting.
I want to read what you're saying reminds me of a slide we often use when we're doing strategic planning with organizations. And this is a quote from a Harvard Business Review article back in 1997 from Gary Hamel and C.K. Prahalad. And if you don't know who they are, they're considered often the fathers of the term core competencies in business. And here's what they say about strategic planning. Hilda, you've probably seen this, but if you haven't, I think you'll love this. Here's what they say about strategic planning. It seldom escapes the boundaries of existing business units. It seldom illuminates new white space opportunities. It seldom uncovers the unarticulated needs of the customer. It seldom provides any insight into how to rewrite industry rules. It seldom stretches to encompass the threat from non-traditional competitors. It seldom forces managers to confront their potentially out-of-date conventions. And here's the final sentence, and you'll love this. Strategic planning always starts with what is. It seldom starts with what could be. And that is exactly, I think, exactly what you're saying here. And we've got the same approach. I'm feeling affirmed right now in my approach to strategic planning, Hilda, because one of the tenets we use is we have a question that we like to ask in strategic planning around what are our places of most potential? And it comes from a photography concept, actually, from one of National Geographic's top photographers, DeWitt Jones, who's got a series of training programs and things. But his idea is that to get the extraordinary or creative shot, you have to put yourself in the place of most potential.
Right.
And that you're so right. We can't think about potential as long as we're thinking about, well, what are we going to do about our, you know, out of date IT systems, or what, we just can't seem to get this organization to work with us, or we don't have enough in grant funds to bring on the staff that we need, or we problem.
Oh, and Patrick, it's also when we look at problems in community, you know, you and I have talked in the past about a diagram that I frequently bring up when I'm speaking. And your listeners will envision it. You remember in like third or fourth grade math, we all learned negative numbers. We learned that a minus one plus one equals zero. Those are at the extremes that if you sort of picture that math line that we all had in grade school, we've got minus one on one side, plus one on the other, and then zero in the middle. And what we learned very early on is that you cannot create something positive by eliminating something negative. That minus one plus one doesn't equal 132. Minus one plus one equals zero. So the best we can do when we're trying to eliminate a negative condition is to get to stasis, is to get to zero. The question of, we need to eliminate poverty. What will happen once we eliminate poverty? Oh, we haven't gotten there yet. Okay, what if we asked instead, what would great look like for our community? What would an equitable, enriched, alive community look like? Now, can we get there without eliminating poverty? Absolutely not. So we fix our problems on the way to that plus one. But if we keep working within that range of minus one to zero, what we actually wind up doing is, and this is a natural tendency as well, we're just one organization. We will never completely eliminate, pick your thing, homelessness, hunger, mm-hmm. literacy, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But if we can reduce it by, let's say, 30% on X side of town with X people. So what we're actually saying is we're at minus five and we'll be totally good if we get to minus two. We never get anywhere near, and that's where we live. That is where, as social change agents, social entrepreneur, government programs, it doesn't really matter. That is where we live. And that's why that first of the three questions of catalytic thinking is a set of questions around what is possible, and then what does it take to get there? What are the dominoes, the conditions we can put in place? Because life is cause and effect.
Yep.
What are the cause and effect conditions that, just like dominoes, will ripple, 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 and push that last domino down? And so that first set of questions is really all about what does it take to create what is possible rather than reacting to what is wrong. I mean, one of my favorite quotes is Buckminster Fuller, who says, you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. And it's reaching for that what's possible piece.
Yeah. The Heath brothers wrote a book a few years back called Switch, and they talk about that concept as well. Their framing of it is to replicate the bright spots, that rather than go in and find all the things that are wrong, find out what's working right and how do we create more of that? Why is this person missing what's right over here and replicating that? And it's, we could talk about appreciative inquiry. We could talk about the science behind don't forget the milk, for example, you know, instead of please remember the milk.
Remember the milk.
You know, exactly. The language we use is important. The words we choose and the Absolutely. Stories we tell ourselves and the questions we ask ourselves.
Absolutely.
I'd keep walking us through this questions framework.
Absolutely. The second set of questions is all around whether we suspect each other or trust each other. They are questions around what does it take to work together? What can we accomplish together that none of us can accomplish on our own? And what does it take for us to work together and build trust? And, you know, there's a million questions that we ask in our day-to-day. You know, one of my favorites, and I'm asked this by marketing people frequently about creating the future, is who is your competition and how do you differentiate yourself from them? We're all asked that, right? Mm-hmm. And my answer is always, we don't have competition. And it's not, oh, we're so wonderful, we don't have any competition. And it's not that garbage. It is that if I see us, if we see ourselves as in competition with people we need to differentiate ourselves against, then that's what we'll do. We see everybody who is doing similar work to us as potential partners. And I don't want to know what we have different. I want to know what we have in common so that we can have conversations and we can work together.
Yeah.
But again, all of those systems lead us to suspect each other and mistrust each other. How can we protect ourselves to make sure that people don't cheat? You know, the whole realm of human resources. I was part of a podcast on human resources right after Labor Day, just talking about what would it look like if human resources were actually about bringing out the best in people rather than expecting us to screw up. And here's the rules for when you do screw up. Mm-hmm. We've again embedded those questions into our systems. And again, creating change is at, even at the very, very beginning, starting to ask questions like, whatever change we make, whatever decision we make, who will be affected by that decision? Not just who's the target audience. Mm-hmm. You know, narrow your focus immediately so that you can get to that target. No, who's going to be impacted whether they are our target audience or not? Because when we fail to ask that question, we are inviting unintended consequences. And then we say, well, how could we have known? Well, you might could have asked them. I mean, it's real simple, but we ignore everybody that's going to be impacted by what we are doing because we are taught. And again, these are things we are taught. We are taught to focus on that narrow target audience. So if I'm going to put out I'll give you a very concrete example. We have classes at Creating the Future that are click and play classes. We have learning opportunities pages for each of them, which some people might call a promotions page. And when we use catalytic thinking for everything, and so when we used catalytic thinking for creating one of those learning opportunities pages for one of our classes, the first question we asked is, who will be affected by this page? So it comes down to the concrete of that. It doesn't have to be huge and esoteric. Who will be affected by this page? Well, it'll obviously be people who may buy the class. Yay! And that's where you tend to go when it's a sales page, when it's a promotions page. The only ones we care about are the ones we can get to buy the class. And then we said, you know what? probably 95% of the people who come to this page are not going to buy the class. So what do we want this page to make possible for them? And small adjustments. If you want to learn a little bit more about this topic, here's a video you can watch. Here's some questions you can ask. Here's a quiz you can take. Simply by incorporating and engaging and acknowledging that every human is valuable, and these people, they wouldn't have clicked on the button if they weren't curious. Do we want to encourage their curiosity, or do we want to say, if you don't have $49, we don't care about you? And again, that's where we have this tendency to go. So that second set of questions really is about, what does it take to embrace everybody, to bring everybody into the play? And that's what movements do. That's you know, that difference between movements and organizations, that's what successful movements for change do. They bring in everybody. They acknowledge everybody's strengths. They build on everybody together.
I think this is one of those things that a whole lot of people embrace when they hear it. It makes good sense. It's inspiring. It's just so hard to beat up against the systems that we are living within. You said it a while ago, we're trying to fix a system using the system we're trying to fix, or something like that. And it's so true, because, for example, the competition. Well, okay, well, let's play that. I'll play with you on this one. And again, this is back to that statement that I said I remember you saying so well about how we want our the grantees that we fund, if we're a funder, to collaborate. But we, even as funders, we're in competition for the brand and for the credit and for all of that. And, but the challenge is, correct me if I'm wrong, the challenge is, as much as I want to believe that and want to change that, I still am operating in that competitive system. For example, I am competing for board members. Talent on our board. I'm competing for talent on our staff. I'm competing for that visibility, because if I want the town council or the city or the school system to pay attention, it's like we're competing for attention, if nothing else, because there's so much noise out there. There's so much that are grabbing people's attention, and when we need the attention, for example, of the policymakers and politicians, well, we know how politics works. The politicians, their attention is going where they have something to gain from that. You know, it's like, how do you manage that whole competitive space with a collaborative mindset when you know that the reality is still that we live in this system where everything is, competition, and everything is scarce, and everything is.
Yep. We just don't have to. You don't have to play along. It is so remarkable, the examples over and over again. People who are driven, and again, you know, you mentioned sustainability before. Everything we're taught, if you get a degree in nonprofit management or social enterprise, if you go to any nonprofit resource center, you take any class, it's about how to sustain your organization. Well, who gives a about your organization? The question is, what do you want to see change in your community? So if the reality is you're there to create change, are you willing to, years ago, I first got into consulting. So this is, you know, however many decades, I don't want to confess it was. There was a consultant that blew my mind, because the first question she asked, the last question she asked when she was talking to a new prospective client, was, if it winds up that the thing that needs to change is you, are you willing to change? Yeah. And that's the question for organizations.
It really,
you know,
is.
I remember years ago when I used to do a lot of teaching, and I would do community-wide workshops on governance. So the first question I would ask people would be the question, the creating question. What would the community look like? If you were 100% successful, what would the community look like? And guaranteed, out of that group of 100 people, 200 people in a room, somebody would raise their hand and they would say, we might go out of business. As if that were a bad thing or a good thing. It's not, I'm not suggesting everybody's job is to put themselves out of business. I'm suggesting that these people had never thought about the most important thing is not your organization.
Right. That's right.
Your organization is means to an end. And so when we focus on that in our minds, what we find is we will go into funders and we'll say, I'm not going to do this by myself. I'm only going to do this with three other organizations. I like your grant application, but I'm not going to answer your questions. I'm going to answer different questions. And could I encourage you, Mr. Funder, to please ask different questions?
Yeah.
So we don't have to play. Mm-hmm. We think we do because this whole funding system makes us feel supplicant. And that leads to my third question. And the third set of questions is about resources. We have, again, this is societal. If I say resources, you think money. And money is not a resource. Money is a placeholder. Money is a means of exchange for what I need, for what I have. And it makes it easy. It is a means of exchange. But what we really want are those things we really need, the things that money buys us. Those are the real resources. Mm-hmm. We need cars, we need buildings, and we need people, and we need, that's the real resources. And the thing that we have found, we talk about it at Creating the Future as collective enoughness, that together we have everything we need because those resources are all around us and they're easy to share. We can share our time, we can share our cars, we can share our buildings. And the more we start to look at resources and say, what do we have that we can share together? We're actually building community in the very process of doing the work to fund, to resource the organization. If we stop thinking about funding and we start thinking about what does it really take if all of us are trusting each other and all of us are sharing our resources, do we really need to have 20 part-time bookkeepers for all the small organizations in town? Or could one foundation say, you know what, we've got a bookkeeper and we're sharing it and that works. There's a million things that we can share. But again, it takes a different mindset. And the reason we focus on questions, Patrick, is that what we realized, and this is another piece in answer to your question of why isn't change happening. It is a no-brainer if I were to say our actions create our results. There you go. Okay, duh, of mm-hmm. course. Mm-hmm. But what creates our actions is our thinking.
Our thoughts, yeah.
And what we tend to do in the world of social innovation is all around changing our actions. We'll do something different. Well, that didn't work. What could we do that's different? If we keep doing the same, a whole bunch of different things without changing the thinking, then we're actually doing the same thing.
It's great.
And years ago, it's how the tagline at Creating the Future, change the questions, change the world, came about. Years ago, someone said at some point, well, you know, it's hard to change your thinking. And we said, no, it's not. If you change the questions you're asking, it changes your thinking. And what we started to realize is that our assumptions and our beliefs are actually answers to questions we don't even realize we're asking. Mm,
that's
so
good.
So a simple example, is the world flat or is it round? I have assumptions, it's either flat or it's round. Mm. I believe it's either flat or it's round. The question is, what's going to happen if I go out there? All of our assumptions and all of our beliefs are actually answers to questions that we don't realize we're asking. Mm. And so if we can be mindful about the questions, that will shift our thinking and that will shift our actions. And that's what catalytic thinking, it's why inserting, just as you said, inserting that one question at that one time, mm-hmm. Can just completely shift a conversation from going into the weeds and spiraling down to, oh, wow, that is possible. And we could do that.
That's right. And it does unlock so much when you ask the right questions. So let me play devil's advocate again. And let me speak on behalf of some of the people I know that are listening right now going, Hildy, that's awesome, wonderful, beautiful. You sound lovely, but get real. Like, you know, what fantasy land are you living in? Because I can change my mindset. It's everybody else's mindset that's holding me up. Like, you know, we can change our mindset all day long, but we're in a world and a community and a business construct and an environment where everybody else's thinking isn't changed. So we do have to play the game. Like, I can change my mind, but it's always about someone else's mindset and the fact that, okay, I can change it, but everybody else's isn't changing. So my changing my mindset's not gonna change the world, right? So what's your response to that?
Is that old? Everyone is crazy except thee and me,
that's
and
exactly
I have
right.
my doubts about thee.
Yeah.
The power of questions. You don't have to change your mindset. I'm not asking anybody out there to change your mindset. I'm just asking you to change the questions.
That's great.
You ask.
That's great.
And if you change the questions you ask, you can change the questions you ask yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I have a practice every at the end of every day. The first question I ask myself is, what am I feeling? And these days, frequently, it's cranky because there's a lot to be cranky about these days in this current world that we're living in. But my second question is, okay, what would good look like?
Yeah, that's right.
And I can ask these questions of myself, but I can ask these questions of others. So I'm not asking people to change their mindset. I'm just asking you to change the questions you ask.
That's so good.
I'll give you a real quick example. One of our fellows at Creating the Future sits on the school board in a small community. And I am of the belief that if you sit on a school board, you go straight to heaven. there are few places that are as difficult to be as sitting on a school board. And she sits on a school board. And as pretty much every school board I have ever experienced, they talk about money. They rarely talk about kids. They talk about money. And the school board they were in that spiral. They were going down, and for 20 minutes and 25 minutes and 30 minutes, they were talking about the finances. And finally, Nancy piped up at one point and said, "What does this have to do with our vision for a community where every child reaches their potential?" And to the one they went, "Oh," and it just shifted the conversation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So all she had to do was lob a question out there.
Yeah, I've always
lobbing a question at a staff meeting. It doesn't matter where you are. You can change everything. We call it leading from the middle.
That's
you
right.
You don't have to have positional authority. You just have to the power to change one question.
It's influence, and which is leadership. And I've often said, in rooms where important people are, I've always had the impression that the smartest people in the room were the ones that would ask that question. You know, that one that would just be sitting there for a while and then say, I have a question. Like, what does this have to do? Those to me have always been what I consider to be the smartest people in the room. I'll tell you something else I'd love your feedback on is the binary question trap. So, you know, the either or, do we merge or don't we? Well, that's a yes or no. And you really limited when you say that. There's probably a ton of answers in between. I was coaching someone recently who was considering pursuing a CEO role at a nonprofit. And his question was, I'm asking myself right now, do I want this? Well, that's a yes or no question. And I said, can I suggest maybe reframing that question? What do you want? You know, that's a different question. Do I want this? That's yes or no. Do I want yes and no, or yes or no. But what do you want? Like, who are you? What will bring you fulfillment? What does a fulfilling career, vocation, life contribution look like to you? Does that lead you down the path to CEO-ship? Great. Does it lead in five potential pathways? Great. But it opens up more than just, oh, I have yes or no. I have door number one or door number two. Do you find that binary thinking is limiting?
Yes and.
Okay.
Sometimes
just,
there is.
I just asked you a binary question, by the way.
Sometimes,
so I'm
yeah,
not practice. Yeah, I'm not practicing what I'm preaching.
That's okay.
Let me ask it this way.
It's just you and me. Nobody else is listening,
yeah,
Patrick. We're
right.
good.
I hope that's not quite the case. So let me correct myself. Let me reframe the question.
Sure.
What are your thoughts on binary questions and their value and their limiting factors?
We do have a tendency to binary ourselves. And so the wonderful coaching questions that you just exemplified are powerful. Once you've opened that up and you can actually look at, okay, what are the factors upon which I want to base this decision? And matrix that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are times where it is a binary decision, where there is absolutely a yes or no, an either or an or.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And what we found very helpful in those very narrow circumstances, we have a tendency, and again, this is cultural, we're going to compare pros and cons. We're going to make a list of pros and a list of cons. And we could have a list of 20, 30, 40 pros and two cons and decide not to do it. And the reason we decide not to do it is because the cons are speaking to our fears and the pros are speaking to our aspirations. And again, your brain is going to go where the fear goes. And so what you're actually asking in pros and cons is apples and oranges. You're comparing your aspirations to your fears, and you're asking your brain to choose aspiration over fear. And we don't do that. We're not built to do that. Mm-hmm. And so what we have found effective is compare fear to fear and aspiration to aspiration. And there are two sets of questions. So let me use your colleague who's trying to decide whether to be a CEO or not. We talk about it as worst, worst, and possible, possible. What's the worst that could happen if you choose to be the CEO? What's the worst that could happen if you choose not to be the CEO? Now I'm comparing fear to fear. So what is the worst if I choose to be a CEO? Well, I'll spend less time with my family. I don't know if I want the responsibility. What is the worst that could happen if I choose not to be the CEO? Well, I may be limiting my future. And now you can choose which of those worsts is worse. Which of those worst scares you more? So you're actually comparing apples to apples. The other comparison is aspiration to aspiration. What would it make possible if, and we ask that question a lot. That is a creating question. What would it make possible if I choose to be CEO? What would it make possible if I choose not to be CEO? And which of those possibilities is more exciting to me? And you can ask both sets of questions, but it is comparing the worst to the worst. Compare your fears to your fears. Let your fears talk and figure out what is the worst for you. Compare your aspirations to your aspirations.
Hildy, I love that.
And in binary situations, that is a helpful way to get the brain out of it.
I love that. I really do. And I won't take the time to get into, give me some examples of when binary is the right approach, or when there is no escape from the binary. Or maybe we can, but...
Well, frequently, Patrick, what you'll find is once you have that conversation, either with yourself or with others, you find other options.
Yeah.
The other options open up.
Well, I think of some work by Rushworth Kidder, for example. He wrote a great book on ethics called How Good People Make Tough Choices. And he talks about an ethical dilemma as not a choice between right and wrong. That he says that's moral temptation. When you know what's wrong, but you have a choice to make. Do I want to do it because there's some benefit, or do I not want to do it? An ethical dilemma he describes as a choice between right and right. So for example, what we often think of a binary, he uses the example of a young journalist at a newspaper who's caught plagiarizing for a feature article. And the question is, do I fire them or don't I? Well, that's binary. That's a yes or no. And both, he made a case that both are correct, because one says that mercy is the right thing. The other says justice is the right thing. Well, you can't do both, can't you? Like, is there a trilemma in there somewhere? Is there a third option? So that really has helped frame my thinking. As you were talking, I love the putting the aspirations with the aspirations on one side of the equation and the negatives with the negatives. And it made me go back to your number line that you talked about. We have 0 and then -1 + 1. It made me think about math again, because if you think about an algebraic equation where you're solving for X, what you do to one side, you have to do to the other. Remember that concept, right? If I'm going to subtract 2 from this, subtract 2 from over here. And that's how you actually literally solve for X. That's what, right? I thought of when you were describing that, you know, if you're going to talk fear or cons, talk cons on both sides. What you do to one side, you have to do to the other, and then you weigh it out and solve for X. Ah, that's so cool.
I love it. I've never thought of it in mathematical terms, but that's beautiful.
That's fantastic. Beautiful. Okay. So we've talked about, this first set of questions about what we want, what path will get us there. The second set of questions around things like, you know, trust versus suspicion types of things. What else is there to this?
And that third set of questions around resources.
Around resources. So that's
resources.
So it's three sets. three sets of
questions. Yeah. Well, okay. What we have found is it's sort of the three legs of a stool. Mm-hmm. That it is purpose, it is people, it is resources. And if you any one of these questions will free you up, will mm-hmm. create a more life-giving conversation, a more energized conversation, a more creative conversation. All three of those questions together, though, are where the strength is. And there are many, catalytic thinking, we don't claim to have invented anything. We have basically just been studying, and from all realms, it doesn't matter if it is faith realm, if it is from the business memes, from appreciative inquiry to collective impact. We have been studying what works, what is actually effective in bringing out the best in people. Because so many of the memes that we've talked about here bring out the worst in us, and we just keep doing them. And it is really combining all of those into catalytic thinking. And the more we can focus on what we know traditionally works to bring out the best in people, why do we keep doing the other? why do we keep doing the other? And the fear and the scarcity about resources will drive away any sense of purpose and any sense of trust. So if we don't focus on that resource piece and really shift the conversation about resources, and there's wonderful, wonderful examples of groups where a funder in the Northwest wanted to do something in rural communities. I'm not remembering exactly what the issue was, but wanted to do something and was letting out a grant. And several of the community leaders and several of the tribes, because up in the Northwest, that was an active part of what was going on in the rural parts of the state, came together and told the funder, "We will not play your game. We know you have, let's say, $1 million that you're going to divide up among us. We will take the $1 million, all of us together, or we won't play." And the thing that we don't realize as organizations is we have the power. They just have money. They can't do a damned thing with it without us. And if you are a food bank, if you are a literacy group, if you are an educational institution, funders can do nothing without you. You have the power. And that, again, is changing that mindset, changing that to see what happens if you just ask that question differently. Do we have to do this alone? Can we all work together? Oh, maybe we can.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good, Hilde. And I'm familiar with, as you talk about that, I'm thinking right now of several organizations that I'm familiar with and have even done some work with in the past who are doing that. There are, I think, more and more funders. Are they all there? No, but I've worked with a number of funders just here in our region that are actually saying, look, we're here to help you do what you like. They do get that. The funders, many of the funders do get that. There's this distrust on both sides.
It's a lack of leadership.
It is.
I'll bring you back to, it is seeing yourself as, the modern term for it is servant leadership, but Lao Tzu was talking about it 2000 years ago. Mm-hmm. It is seeing yourself as the highest potential that you have is supporting and bringing out the potential in others. And as funders, understanding that their highest potential is to bring out, to engage, elicit the highest potential in members of their community, mm-hmm. rather than, and I would say, I'm not even go to the rather than, because I have seen so few funders who have that, well, we've got the money, we'll do what we want attitude. I don't see it. Those who are looking for funds may feel it because mm-hmm. so many hoops to jump through and so many applications. And we really need to come to each other from a place of we're all doing our best. We all want the world to be a better place. We all want our communities to be a better place. And if we had a better way, we would do a better way. And it's not as if we're presented with a way, here's a way that your work could be 100% more effective. And what it will take is a couple of shifts over here and your work will be 100% more effective. Nobody's going to say, yeah, no, I like it ineffective. And if they do, great. Those are the ones, you know, you don't want to work with.
That's right.
But we have the ability to go where the water's warm, to walk with people who feel the same way and see the same possibilities that we see. And that's where the work is way more joyful.
I have a few more things I want to try to cram in here.
Oh, God.
You mentioned charity a while ago and the, you know, going back to the sort of church philosophy around charity and helping one person at a time. One of the continuums, dichotomies, juxtapositions, call it what you want, that we've talked a lot about in our work through the years is the difference between charity and change. And nonprofits who are in the very conventional human service field, who are feeling that tension of, we are a charitable, I mean, literally a charitable organization. We are classified as a charitable. They call us a charity. We're here to help people. We have these people, maybe it's a food bank or a soup kitchen or a homeless shelter. Charity, someone needs help. We're going to give you help. Okay. Versus change, which is, and I say versus, I'm going to come back to that. But versus change, where you eliminate the need for charity by changing the conditions that made charity necessary. So, and I had someone challenge me on that dichotomy and said, why are you using versus? You know, why can't charity lead to change? Why can't charity be change charity? Why can't change be charity? Like, why is there the difference between the two? And we could, I don't want to unpack too much out of this, but I would love your thoughts on that since you do talk about the origins of our systems around charity and your work around catalytic thinking and systems change. How do you reconcile between those two terms?
I come back to that math line, come back to that minus one, zero, plus one. If I'm in minus one, if I'm in minus 100, if I am in a community that is dealing with poverty, dealing with racism, dealing with all of these systemic issues that our communities are facing, the only way that we can get to an equitable, humane, healthy, safe, beautiful, joyful, vibrant community in that plus one is if we climb out of minus one. So it's not an either or. It is a means to an end. The difference is when we see helping one person at a time as the ends. And if we see helping one person at a time as one of many means towards creating the world that we want, it is one of many means. And so you will see food banks, great example, who are feeding people because people need food. But they're also doing nutrition programs. They're also doing farming programs. They're also doing self-sufficiency programs. They're also teaching financial literacy. They're also working with jobs. They're also working with in collaboration with other organizations so that they can create a community that doesn't need a food bank. That doesn't negate the need for charity right now.
Beautiful.
People are hurting. But it is a continuum, and it really is part of what has happened. And this is not just in social change. This is globally. If you want to know why the financial sectors keep falling apart, is that we have a cultural, societal confusion of means and ends. And we see means as ends. And the worst offender of that is the financial sector that sees money as an end. And money is never an end. Because if I got a lot of money and I can't do anything with it because it's the end, then I can maybe fill a bathtub and bathe in it. But there's nothing money is always a means. And the reason that our societal systems, our extremist capitalist systems right now are in such a world of hurt is because we have come to see money as the ends, not the means. Mm. And it's just a means. But it's the same thing with social change. We have got to see helping people as one of many means towards the society that we want.
I love it. It's not an either or, it's a both and. One more question before I get to my sort of bookend boilerplate questions for you to wrap this up. For our naysayers, you mentioned early on that, you know, in your early consulting career, you'd go in and you do this consulting and things didn't really change. And what you're doing now, you said something to the effect of we started to see some actual shifts and some actual movements. Can you maybe provide even one example of someone you've worked with or a community you've observed or an example where this achieving of something possible and changing the game has occurred because of this catalytic thinking? And like, what are some of the early signs that you've seen or some of the great work that you've seen? Just an example or two that we can kind of get our head around.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If folks are interested, my TEDx talk has a wonderful example of an AIDS organization that was able to rethink their purpose in terms of helping people who had AIDS, people who were suffering with HIV and AIDS, to building a community that was compassionate, understanding, aware in their vision statement, which they claim to this day, and it was 11 years ago they did this work. They still claim that vision statement they created is the most powerful thing in their work, which is that everyone is free to live healthy, vital lives. And to them, interestingly, for an HIV and AIDS organization, it wasn't the healthy, vital lives that was so powerful, but the free. And what they do constantly is working at building a compassionate community where people are free to live those healthy, vital lives. Taking it for, and you'll see that in my TEDx talk, we did a demonstration project with a statewide Department of Education about 2 years ago, and they were looking at cultural shift within the organization. And part of what they were looking at was, many of us are familiar with the fact that social and emotional intelligence in many school districts is taught as content to the kids. And what the conversations we were having started to reveal is that it was one thing to have that as content taught to the kids, but social and emotional intelligence were nowhere present among the adults in the school systems. So there was no trust. There was no, the administration was, there's a lot of us and them. And so looking at the shifts in, first of all, that aha, and then second of all, bringing in everybody to the conversation, who will be impacted, whatever we do, bringing everyone in. And they had there's 200 people in that statewide Department of Education, and all 200 people were involved in the conversation. And the conversation aimed at what would good look like, and good would look like, how would it look on the ground with teachers in schools? How would it look in our interrelationships with each other? And they looked at each and every one of those, you know, who will be affected, to say what would good look like for them. It is a long-term process. It is a complex, and I always focus on complex rather than complicated. Things don't have to be complicated, but they are complex. They're interwoven. But as a result of that, their strategic plans that they need to submit to the state and the feds every year now include a goal around cultural competency and social and emotional intelligence for the adults in the system. And they created systems, they created a whole bunch of systems and how we do things. They changed, and we basically see the word system as how we do things. They changed how they do things so that they were aligned behind what they wanted to see. But again, it came from asking, what would good look like? Interestingly, Patrick, I love this part of the story, is in talking with the superintendent, he initially said, well, I'm thinking about doing a survey and asking people what they think is wrong. And I said, what do you think they're going to tell you? And he listed it all. And I said, well, why are we doing a survey?
Why are you asking?
Why are we asking? And secondly, many people don't like to fill out surveys. And what they wound up doing just in that first round, they changed the questions. What would a good culture look like? How would we know? What would we see? What would we feel? What would we hear? What do you think would lead to that? What conditions would need to be in place? Not what are the challenges? What are the obstacles? Which again, triggers our brains to say, oh, there's challenges. But what would lead to that? What would create that? And they did it multimodal. They did surveys. They did small conversations. They did one-on-one interviews. The superintendent did for several months what he was calling once a week coffees with the chief, and just bringing people in and asking those questions. And so it was identifying, and I guess this is probably the most important piece, is that these are not systems in a vacuum. These are people who create the systems and maintain the systems. And how do people respond best to these questions? So they asked affirmative, aspirational questions. The conditions for success, what needs to be in place, would have been the exact same thing if they had asked, what are the challenges and barriers? But in this way, it is framed in a way that this is a condition that will, this is a domino we can put into place, rather than, oh, how are we going to get past this? And doing it in ways that was about how many different ways can we listen to people, rather than here's the survey, answer it. Well, nobody answered the survey.
Yeah, well, that's
they obviously don't care.
That's what I was thinking as you were talking, is that it, among all the other positive things that you mentioned there, it actually does listen. It creates a sense of autonomy for people, because they feel like I have a say and I have a voice. I have an idea. Somebody's Absolutely. Listening. Somebody's asked, somebody values what I think and what I envision. So yeah. I love that.
Yeah. And one of the very concrete things that came out of it, because all state departments wind up in the U.S. being sources for funneling federal funds, is they changed their grant applications. They changed their grant applications to have more catalytic questions. And we find that, you know, startsomegood.com is a crowdfunding platform that also changed their grant, their applications years ago. They were asking, what is the problem you want to solve and what will you do to solve it? And they started asking, what is the future you want to create and what steps are you taking to create that? And what they found in the crowdfunding is that people raised more money when they asked about what you want to create.
So I really do love this, but I want to be clear about something. And again, for everyone, it's not that you can't address problems, barriers, obstacles. It's that where they fit in the question framework is important, in what order. So when you ask the question, what do you want and what's the path and what does good look like? There is a point in the process where you say, what's standing in the way of that, right?
Nope.
No, no. Okay.
Nope.
Well, then where do you address
nope.
it?
We don't, because conditions for, so if I were to ask you, Patrick,
it just happens automatically.
If I were to ask you, what are some of the barriers right now to creating a more equitable world? Mm. Give me one or two barriers to creating a more equitable world.
Political frameworks and systems.
Political systems. Okay. And if I were to ask you, what conditions need to be in place for us to have a more equitable world? What would need to be in place? You'd probably say, well, we would need political systems that address equity. We would need, and so by naming it, this is what our brains do. Mm-hmm. You mentioned before the don't forget versus remember.
Right.
Our brains latch onto negative and go into fear and reactive mode. Mm. When we say challenges, barriers, what will stand in the way, I go, oh, crap, that's all. That's too much. I can't get past that. But if I ask that same question, what needs to be in place? Frequently, we hear this with trust. So people will say, yeah, but that'll never work because nobody trusts each other. Mm-hmm. And so if I were to ask instead, what needs to be in place? And people say, well, people need to trust each other. And I'd say, okay, and what would need to be in place for people to trust each other? Well, they would need to know each other. They would need to spend time with each other. All of that is coming from a framework that is letting your brain do the work. Because if I said to you, oh, you're right, nobody trusts each other. Are there other barriers to trust? Your brain's going to go right down that rabbit hole and we ain't getting back.
Yeah.
And so we just don't ask it.
Right. Okay. So then what's important there then is, we're back to the right question. So you have to ask the right
questions.
Right. You have to ask the effective questions that do address existing obstacles, barriers, but not.
Have you ever met somebody who's got a debilitating disease and you would never know it because they are awesome and they go about their lives and they just go, sure. And that debilitating disease would have you on the couch watching soap operas all day long. When we call something a challenge and a barrier, we turn it into a challenge and a barrier. So we just don't use that language. And what we talk about is these are conditions. They're basically unmet conditions for success.
Right.
And if we talk about them as conditions for success, rather than talking about them as barriers and obstacles, our brains do different things.
Right. I think we are actually saying the same thing because because I do hear that. What I'm saying is the right or effective questions address, let me rephrase it. They address what people typically see as barriers, obstacles, challenges, but they force a different language and framework that open up again, the catalytic thing. They open up that space for the catalyst is what they do.
And that is exactly why we call it catalytic.
Yeah. That's great.
It is just a tiny adjustment and everything changes. Mm. Everything changes.
So good. So good. Hilde. Wow. We have to do this again.
Because we could talk all day long.
We really sure could. So I do want to ask you this. I ask all my guests this, and you might have hinted to one of these a little earlier, but I'll let you say this. Where did you get this thinking from? Like you've got to this place of very clear theory and philosophy and mindset and approach to leadership and these questions. Who are some of the people maybe in your early life or career, the leaders that impacted you, that whether they practiced this or didn't practice this, that have influenced who you are as a leader today? Who are one or two people that come to your mind when I ask that question?
You know, it's interesting. I'm glad you asked about who didn't, because probably the primary disillusionment in my life, I had thought from early on that I was going to run for office. I always wanted to change the world. Like I said, I was brought up watching the news at the dinner table and discussing, and I got a political science degree, political science and economics degree, got my first job with an elected official, and a maverick elected official, the one who was out there really kicking butt and changing things. And I quickly learned that change does not happen within the political process and within the elected process, that they're very good at reacting to. But I was so disillusioned with the fact that the political system so dampens innovation, so steps on innovation. And so that first taste at a really early age, I was right out of college, that change happens with people, that the people create change. It's that old 60s adage, if the people will lead, the leaders will follow. That was my first taste of real disillusionment with someone who I thought was really going to be the leader. And what I found over time, you know, you talked about developing this framework. We experimented a lot. And we tried a lot of questions, and if they didn't lead to something positive, then we discarded those questions. And the things that I found is that there weren't individual leaders where I could say, that person, I want to follow everything they do, they're awesome. There's such inspiration in every human if we encourage them to be their best and tell their story. That is an ongoing source and always has been for me. It is, and I guess it comes from asking the questions that bring out those stories from people, because you find that inspiration. People who don't think they're leaders, they're certainly not positional leaders, but they're doing incredible things, even in their own lives with their own families. And to me, it's finding that leadership in everybody, finding that inspiration in everybody. And I guess that's just something that naturally I did, but that was really the point for me. There's never been a single person.
That's good though. We do form our positions sometimes as much on disappointments and disillusions as we do those inspiring, you know, somebody told me once and it was a great quote and it changed my life. I love it. Last question, Hildy, if you had 15 seconds to give the world your number one, your most important, most valuable tenet of leadership for leaders, what would that be? What's the sort of number one thing we should all be thinking about and paying attention to as leaders?
You know, it is always about the people. It's never about the thing. It's not about the computer problem. It's about what the computer problem means to the people. It's not about the tsunami because that's just an event. It is about what the tsunami means to people. And if we can, by the questions we ask, by the way we be in life, bring out the best in the people around us, then magic happens.
Wow. That's incredible. Oh, this has been such a rich conversation. I knew this was going to be good. I've learned something every time I've come in contact with you, Hilda. You really do open up thinking. I appreciate it so much. Thanks for coming on the show. Creatingthefuture.org. Really go there. And when you get there, sign up for the newsletter because that's where you'll see a lot of this work, all the opportunities and resources where you can get engaged and engaged. Hildy and her team are right there. Creatingthefuture.org. Go there. Hildy, thanks again. Happy New Year. Let's make it better. We can do it, right?
Oh, I sure know we can. Yeah, well, it was delightful, Patrick. Thank you so much.
All right. All right, folks. We'll see you here next week. Lead on.